Welcome to the Am I Hunting Podcast. Thanks for tuning in as always. Today's episode is one that's kind of well overdue, but it's one that I did want to make sure I got out because there are some important stories that I'm going to highlight today on this episode of the Conservation News Desk. Primarily stories from the month of February. I know we're into March. Like I said, delayed on this one. But there are a few key stories I do want to make sure I get highlighted from the month of February. But before we get into those stories, as always, if you like this episode, make sure you hit that like button, subscribe to the channel, share the show with your friends. And again, if you want to get all the content available from the Am I Hunting Podcast, head on over to amihuntingpodcast.com where you'll get all the episodes, videos, articles that are coming out on a monthly basis, as well as check out the store for any logo wear. And if you want to support the show more directly, head on over to the Join Us button, become a member. Your membership supports this show directly, as well as gives you exclusive members-only content and discounts on anything in the store for the life of your membership. So without further ado, let's jump into these stories that we have for today. All right, for this first story, it comes to us from MichiganPublic.org. Nearly 2,000 Arctic grayling released in three Michigan lakes as part of reintroduction effort. So this story in particular came out in February, but it looks like the reintroduction process actually took place back in November. This is just when this story kind of caught wind highlighted this, and I caught wind of the story and what they were doing. I had heard rumors that they were going to be reintroducing Arctic grayling, but I didn't get any additional details on that. So this story here is going to highlight those reintroduction efforts. So again, this reintroduction took place on November in 2023. So let's get into the story here. The release of these well-traveled grayling represents a milestone in Michigan's plan to reestablish the species to the state. They are the first free-swimming grayling in Michigan in nearly a century. Their generation was so successful at surviving hatchery life, where illness and mechanical problems pose a threat, that there were enough extra fish to stock a few lakes, giving anglers a chance to hook a Michigan icon. So when the fisheries production manager for the DNR went on to say, at any time of developing a brood stock, you always start with more eggs than you think are going to be needed. As it turns out, these two-year classes of brood stock have done exceptionally well in the hatchery system, so it allowed us to give a surplus of fish available to stock out and provide angling opportunities really early on this program. And that's from Ed Each. So in October, Michigan Department of Natural Resources Commission amended regulations to allow anglers to catch and release Arctic grayling, which is still illegal to harvest the species. Grayling were once abundant in northern Michigan streams, and they became an important commercial and sport species in the state. By 1936, overfishing, habitat degradation from logging, and the introduction of predatory species like brown trout had extirpated grayling from Michigan. In 2016, the DNR, in partnership with the Little River Band of Ottawa Indians, launched a Michigan Arctic Grayling Initiative. Their goal is to reestablish self-sustaining populations of Arctic grayling within previous historic range. No. The adult grayling release into Ambler County's West Johns Lake, Holton County's Pendegar Lake, and Manistee County's Pine Lake will likely not reproduce. They did not have a chance to imprint on the water as fry and won't recognize it as breeding ground. The program is quite close to establishing grayling populations that can reproduce. Ed goes on to say, we're hopeful that we may see first eggs going into remote site incubators and Michigan streams as soon as spring of 2025. We're getting really close to being able to full production with this operation. We'd be at the point of actively stocking streams fertilized eggs. The broodstock left behind in the Marquette hatchery will produce eggs that will be placed in remote incubators in Michigan streams. Ideally, the eggs will hatch in those streams, allowing the fry to imprint them and use them as when it's time to reproduce. Ed goes on to say it hopes that the reproduction could happen within 4 to 7 years. He goes on to say it isn't a sprint. We're going to probably take a decade at least before we can say with confidence we've been successful or we haven't. Yeah, the Arctic grayling are worth the effort. Grayling are the kings of northern lower peninsula prior to extirpation. They're kind of an iconic species, which, again, you know, growing up in Michigan, especially, you know, the idea of Arctic grayling being on the landscape or knowing that they once were and just never having them, you know, available, you know, this is a pretty cool introduction. Again, we'll see how they do in the years to come. Again, when it comes to other predatory fish, you know, they may get their numbers decline quite a bit. But again, hopefully with the work that's been done on, you know, maintaining and, you know, caring for the waterways and lakes and streams and rivers for Michigan, that they do well, at least in terms of habitat-wise. Again, with the introduction of other predatory fish, we'll see how well they can do and survive, you know, that peril of life for them. But pretty exciting. Again, more to come on that, on how successful they are in the years to come. All right, so this next story comes to us by MLive.com, published on February 7th. Man convicted of diverting sleeping bear dunes river by hand. Essentially what ended up happening, this one kind of caught a lot of people by off guard, where basically there was the river kind of flowed alongside of the lakeshore and dumped in further downstream. Apparently what had happened was that there was a break in where the river basically kind of got re-diverted, dammed up and re-diverted closer to where the mouth used to be and where the boat launch is. There was a lot of people that were caught off guard with it. And then, you know, there was a big call out from the National Park Service as to what had happened. Well, apparently they knew a little bit more and were able to, complete their investigation. And they were able to catch the person responsible, and they have been convicted for that action. So let's get into the story itself. So a Frankfurt man has been convicted of federal misdemeanor charges after diverted the Platte River with a shovel and rocks. Andrew Blair Howard, 63, was found guilty on one count of tampering and vandalism following a February 7th bench trial before federal judge Ray Kent in Grand Rapids, where prosecutors present footage of the man building a dam by hand. Howard, a local fisherman, was charged last May, followed by a National Park Service investigation into the August 22 change of the mouth of the Poplar River, which empties into Lake Michigan, Sleeping Bear National Lakeshore. According to evidence presented during trial, Howard rechanneled the river to cut through the sandy pit or spit, which had built up along the Platte River shoreline and made recreation access to and from the bay nearly impossible for boats. Which that little detail is going to be key, because they do get into more about kind of what the bigger issue is with this, with what he had done, and kind of the both sides that of allowing the lake, allowing the river to kind of change naturally or to have it be maintained for specific purposes. So the sandy spit was built up over several years to the liking of beachgoers and park managers, who halted 49 years of annual dredging of the river mouth in 2017. But it hampered boat access at the onset of annual fall coho salmon run. So that's the the crux of why he ended up doing that, because you can't get any significant boats in and out of the mouth of the Platte anymore to access Lake Michigan. The Department of Natural Resources officials said that the change benefited the river by lowering the water level upstream and helped alleviate a public safety concern by establishing rescue boats to quickly access the bay. So again, another one that I'd kind of forgotten about with this story is that the DNR, you know, even for like rescue boats or, you know, first responders and whatnot, they can't, if there's anyone that's in trouble out on Lake Michigan, out in front of the Platte River, they have to actually, you know, travel much further distances to boat launches that their boats can actually launch into to be able to provide rescue for them. Oh, the Park Service saw things differently and reacted strongly after Howard threw a wrench in the federal plans to excavate decades of dredge spoils that built up more and build more habitat for piping plovers, an endangered shorebird which is making recovering strides. In a statement, U.S. District Attorney Tom Toden called the prosecution a matter protecting Michigan's natural treasures. Mr. Howard had a policy dispute with the National Park Service and took matters into his own hands, breaking the law rather than using lawful means to advocate for his position. Toden said his actions resulted in significant financial and ecological harm that altered the landscape so many enjoyed. And at this point, sentencing of this case has not been scheduled. So according to the January trial brief submitted by prosecutors, a park ranger witnessed Howard using a shovel and stacking rocks to dam the river on August 15, 2022. The ranger's body footage, or camera footage, and receipts of the Frankfurt hardware store where the shovel was purchased were presented as evidence during the trial. According to the ranger, Howard dammed the river after being unable to navigate his boat into the bay that morning and later caught a coho salmon once the mouth was deepened. After Howard built a dam, the natural power of the river widened the previously shallow Mandarin River river mouth to about the 200 feet that reached an influx of a number of fishermen that came to a Platte River boat launch to take advantage of the favorable conditions of access created by the new channel, according to the trial brief. In December 2023, the Park Service excavated the beach and removed 2,000 cubic yards of rock sand as part of a $328,000 project to build piping plover habitat. Park managers say the new habitat area result in newly restricted area popular beach of plover deciding to nest within new protective berms. Dredging has since been a conflict between federal, state, and local officials since the Park Service ceased dredging in 2013 and stopped the DNR from doing it in 2017. The Park Service called the Pebble Stew Beach an aesthetic irritant to swimmers in its 2016 environmental assessment, which conducted part of the dredge spoils on the beach, preventing dune vegetation becoming established. Local officials say a fully naturalized river mouth impedes both boat access to the bay for fishing and emergency access to craft. Platte Point is the high-use area where multiple swimmers have died, and marine rescue must now either launch from Empire or Frankfurt or come via helicopter. The Park Service has resisted a proposal to establish a nearby alternate launch site directly into the bay out of concern it would cut through habitat of piping plover and threaten the endangered dune plants. So this is a very important story that has come up in regards to whenever you're dealing with the National Park Service, and especially, you know, here locally with the Sleeping Bear Dunes. You know, there's been a strong push, at least from the Park Service, that they basically want to turn everything back to, everything goes back to nature. You know, there's no maintenance completed by the Park Service or, you know, any restoration of any kind. Basically, they want to go back to nature, let nature handle it. However, there are some kind of inconsistencies of their plan or how they manage that. You know, they've basically continued to incorporate more and more properties where people had previously lived, as well as they've been doing over the past few years. They have been implementing controlled burns in parts of the park system. So the idea of them wanting to not, you know, invest into controlled environments and allowing nature to take its course, they are doing certain projects that would counteract what they were basically arguing here in this story. Another topic that's come up recently is that they do have a, basically they're developing or finishing up a hiking slash biking trail that cuts through parts of the Sleeping Bear Dunes. Again, that's managed by the National Park Service. And again, they're looking at doing development for a certain recreation for people to be able to hike and bike, basically a maintained trail that they would, you know, finish developing as well as maintain for, you know, whatever, however many years that they're going to maintain this trail. Same thing. They're looking into, you know, modernizing or, you know, adding infrastructure into parts of the Park Service, and yet they're unwilling to work with local officials, the state DNR, to be able to maintain an active and, you know, usable boat launch. So a little bit of a hot topic in regards to this. You know, not necessarily the, you know, his actions, yeah, are kind of the highlight of this story, but there is an underlying issue that needs to be addressed or, you know, hashed out between, you know, local officials, the state DNR, and the National Park Service. They're going to have to come to some form of agreement to, you know, offer some form of access for recreational boating and fishermen to utilize the Platte River in some manner or fashion to get to Lake Michigan, essentially. So again, this will be an ongoing issue and topic of concern for the area. And I'm sure there's going to be, you know, people on either side of the aisle that are not going to be happy with whatever outcomes, you know, are presented going forward. So again, you know, time will tell as to what the actual, you know, final decision will be on this, on, you know, who's kind of going to kind of win this battle, if it's going to be the DNR and local officials, you know, wanting to be able to maintain the mouth of the Platte a little bit better, or if it's going to be the National Park Service that's going to, you know, basically put their foot down and not work with the state or local officials in this regard. All right, let's get into this next story. This comes from ABC News from February 23. Man who uses drone to help hunters recover deer carcasses to appeal conviction. A Pennsylvania man who uses drones to try to locate wounded deer shot by hunters so they can retrieve their carcasses had been convicted of violating state hunting laws. So Joshua Wingrove, 35, of Downington, plans to appeal his verdict handed down Thursday by Lancaster County District Judge Raymond Scheller. The case apparently marked the first time anyone has been cited or tried in Pennsylvania for using a drone to recover dead game animal. And it hinged on whether Wingrove was involved in hunting as defined by state law. So again, you know, there's a growing trend of people using dogs for deer recovery, you know, after a deer is, you know, shot while hunting. There are a few that are out there that are using drones, using either their spotlights, or another big thing is with their thermal cameras to be able to find, you know, game out in the field. And again, a little bit of a debate in regards to using certain technologies in the pursuit of harvesting game or recovery of game as well. And that's basically what this story is really going to get into. Basically, the laws are a little, I guess, unclear in regards to, you know, this type of technology being utilized and how they ended up convicting him, or how they pursued on their investigation on him. It's almost a little shady, but we'll get into that. So Joshua, who openly advertised his business in area publications, is told by state game wardens last year that such activity was illegal, authorities said, although they told his lawyer that his lawyer sees things differently. On December 6th, an undercover game commission officer contacted Joshua and asked him to meet him to help find a deer that he shot in Welsh Mountain National Preserve. Joshua met the officer, where within an hour, he had the officer sign a waiver stating he wanted to recover a deer carcass, but if the deer was found still alive, he agreed to hunt the deer another day. So this is key. So he got convicted of hunting with a drone. However, he even puts in that if they find the deer and it's still alive, that they are not going to go pursue that animal immediately, that there has to be a time frame after that animal was found and still to be alive. Joshua, who did not know the shot deer story was fabricated and part of a sting operation, soon launched his drone and piloted it around remotely using thermal camera settings to show the scenery in black and white. He soon caught view of a live deer and turned the camera's infrared settings to show it in heat map. He later turned the settings off and activated spotlight to view the deer normally. However, he and the officer were soon approached by game warden, who confiscated the drone and cited Joshua for two counts of using illegal electronic devices during hunting and single count of disturbing wildlife or game or wildlife and violating regulations in recreational spotlighting. Since the legal definition includes tracking, hunting, and recovery, authorities said Joshua technically used the drone to hunt game. He was convicted of all four counts and fined $1,500. Joshua's attorney, Michael Sidden, said his client planned to appeal this verdict. He argues that the trial and the state law concerning the use of devices while hunting are archaic, saying they have been patched over time to cover new technology but not yet addressed for drones. Sidden said if Joshua used the drone to locate an animal before shooting it would be illegal poaching. But Joshua insisted he believed the deer was dead and he only used the drone after hunting hours had ended and was never intending to hunt. So that's the big kind of interesting bit about this story, is that, you know, the topic of using drones for recovery of deer is going to be one that's going to be debated probably over the next several years. Now, me personally, I don't see an issue with drone recovery, but there is always that temptation to use a drone to hunt or to, you know, get on deer or find deer before going in for a hunt. You know, that's always going to be the case. Now, the other part too is, okay, so you fly a drone over a particular property, you see, you know, a target buck or something like that in, you know, on the property, you know, you still have to basically, you know, either, you know, if you're hunting by yourself, you have to land that drone and then go in there and after the deer. Now, I could see an issue in regards to, you know, if you have a pilot flying a drone and you're going in for like a stalk or, you know, hunting in a pair. But again, a lot of states and other, you know, regulations don't allow for like two-way communication while hunting. So even that of itself, it would cause, you know, is, you know, other rules to be broken anyways. So I think that most of what the issue is that a lot of state agencies are not equipped or, you know, prepared for, you know, the use of drones in this regard or for recovery of deer. And they're trying to catch up with the technology being implemented, trying to set rules to make sure that people aren't using them or abusing them in some manner to, you know, I guess, unfairly harvest deer or other game species. I will say this, that they do have to be careful about implementing, you know, punishment in regards to using these drones if they don't have the laws that, you know, directly address this type of technology. Or again, in the instance that he actually has people sign a waiver that they are not going to pursue a live animal, you know, while utilizing the drone. He's using it after hours. And then if he does locate a live deer, that he basically, they have to pursue it the next day. You know, it really goes back to, like, yes, if maybe he was, you know, it was still during daylight and he didn't sign any type of waiver. And, you know, once the deer was alive, he told the conservation officer to go in there and go after it. You know, that would be, yeah, definitely a case of like, yeah, he's using that drone. They're hunting down that deer. But in how he handled it, at least according to the story, you know, he did everything right. And yeah, again, this law probably just needs to be updated to facilitate, you know, using technology, some form of technology to be able to recover wounded deer. You know, once the deer has been wounded, you do want to try to use every resource available to try to either confirm that deer is either alive or dead and to recover it. That way it's not a wasted resource, just rotting out in the field. So again, the story on drones and the use of drones in regards to, you know, hunting and even utilizing them for like video footage, for like hunt shows and whatnot, that's going to be a hot topic for the next few years. And it's up to, you know, game agencies, you know, individual hunters or, you know, videographers and whatnot to hash out the details as to how they can still utilize these drones in, you know, in these instances, but yet, you know, have protections that it's not going to be abused or, you know, cause issues. All right, let's get into this final story. So this is out of Colorado State University, Warren College of Natural Resources. Apex predators, not a quick fix to restoring ecosystems. 20-year study of Colorado State University finds. So I do want to give a little bit of kind of oversight as to kind of what this study is really going over, kind of the bigger issue that they're really looking to cover. So, you know, the study itself gets into kind of some weedy stuff, into some really, you know, stuff that seems really unrelated to kind of what that title suggests. So basically what they're looking at is there's a significant, you know, understanding or belief that, you know, adding, you know, predators like wolves, bears, mountain lions back to a landscape is a trophic cascade effect, where basically by adding these predators back onto the landscape, it's going to fix all the issues, you know, of the landscape. It's kind of like a rebalancing, you know, kind of fix the whole environment, fix all the ecosystem by just putting them back on the landscape and letting them do what they do. Everything will go back to the way it was when they were on the landscape. You know, that's not necessarily the case of what this study is showing. This study itself challenges the commonly held belief that reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone National Park restored the ecosystem degraded by their absence. And this is, this study or this designed type of experiment is the longest conducted ever in regards to the Yellowstone. So it's, again, a 20-year study. So there's a ton of data that they were able to collect and look at kind of a long-term or, you know, extended period of time of with these wolves being reintroduced onto the landscape. So let's get into the story itself. So a Colorado State University experiment spanning more than two decades was found the removal of apex predators from an ecosystem that can create lasting changes are not reversed after they return, at least not for a very long time. So again, looking at that 20-year study, they didn't see any significant change in that regard. Study founded by the National Science Foundation and published challenges the commonly held belief that reintroduction of wolves in the Yellowstone National Park serves restored ecosystems degraded by their absence. CSU's Warren College Natural Resources examined the effects of three apex predator carnivores at the top of the food chain not preyed on by other animals in Yellowstone. Depleted populations of cougars, grizzly bears naturally recovered about the same time where wolves were reintroduced to the park in 1995. The absence of these predators for nearly a century transformed the food web and landscape. Yellowstone's northern range shifted from a willow and aspen stand along streams with beaver activity to grasslands due to intensive browsing by elk. Widespread change stabilized into an alternative ecological state that resisted return to previous conditions once carnivores were restored. This design experiment conducted in Yellowstone is the longest of its kind and adds evidence supporting the theory that degradation of ecosystems may not be reversed when harmful stressors were mitigated. When you disturb an ecosystem by changing the makeup of the food web, it can lead to lasting changes that are not quickly fixed, says Hobbs, lead author and professor with the Department of Ecological Science and Sustainability and the Natural Resources Ecological Laboratory. We can't rule out the possibility that the ecosystems will be restored over the next 40 years as a result of returned apex predators. All we can be sure of is that observable now, the ecosystem has not responded dramatically to the restored food web. They go on to explain this a little bit, kind of break down what the conclusion. So they go on to say, what can Colorado learn from Yellowstone? Colorado Parks and Wildlife introduced wolves, 10 wolves to the state, 18 to 22, with plans to bring in more coming years. Wolves were eradicated in the state in the mid-1940s. May hold lessons about the restored apex predator's effect on the ecosystem. But Hobbs said the environment degradation resulting from Yellowstone's policy not to call elk was never replicated in Colorado. Unlike Yellowstone, Colorado's landscapes have not experienced widespread excessive grazing or browsing from elk. The state has done a good job of managing elk populations using hunting. So this brings up another very good topic about, the difference between the Park Service that no animals are harvested or managed in any way in regards to calling any type of populations of any animals. Whereas the rest of the state in Colorado, their game agencies manage populations. And again, you can see that, they're noting that there's not excessive browse because they're managing the elk herd with hunting as a supplement as well. Hobbs and Cooper said there are many good reasons to restore wolves, but don't expect them to cause immediate ecological or ecosystem improvements. Our work supports the fact that wolves are important components of the ecosystem, and research science immersed the Department of Forest and Rangeland Stewardship. They will have some ecosystem benefits by reducing some large herbivores populations over the next hundreds of years. They'll have a greater role in regulating some of ecological processes that we've been studying. So, and then they get in kind of the crux of kind of why they focus on the willows and aspen trees as kind of their benchmark or marker of change. So wolves and cougars, what do willows have to do with wolves? Wolves and cougars were wiped out in Yellowstone in the 1920s without apex predators or human hunters to control the population. Elk fed on willows along small streams, Yellowstone's northern range, depleting beavers' food supply and building materials that caused them to abandon the streams in favor of more suitable areas. Historical beavers and willows relied on each other to thrive. Flooding caused by beavers, beaver dams created favorable soil moisture conditions for willows, and willows provide food and dam material for beavers. Without beavers' engineered flooding, small streams in northern range cut deeper into the landscape, disconnecting roots of willows from groundwater. Willows never recovered their former height and density. Following the reintroduction of wolves in the park in 1995, as cougars and grizzly populations were rebounding on their own, the elk population dropped from both predation and hunting by humans along park borders. However, overbrowsing of woody food sources has not declined proportionally. As the number of elk have decreased, bison herds have increased. Yellowstone carnivores typically don't prey on bison because of their large size and makes them dangerous. But I did end up, that's funny that they bring that up, because I did see another article in regards to the fact that because of the depleted elk herds in Yellowstone that some of the wolf packs are getting larger and they are taking on bison. They go on long-term experiment. In 2001, began the experiment, gauged whether Yellowstone ecosystems would recover due to restoration of apex predators. They established four study areas in the Northern Parks Range, fenced off eight plots and prevent browsing, constructed simulated beaver dams in some fence and non-fence plots, raised water table. They also left controlled areas unaltered. In 2009, they added 21 more control plots to ensure the results of their experiment were representative of the landscape. If predators regulated the elk population, preventing them from cutting down willows, the landscape would hypothetically return to its previous state. Instead, the willows remained short in controlled plots, while the fence sites where stimulated dams showed dramatic recovery. So again, just like any other experiment, they had their control set up as well as their experimental area, and it showed that, yeah, even though the elk populations and the wolf populations with that dynamic, they didn't note any significant change. You remove those factors and they saw a dramatic difference in those results. Willows grew more than three times taller in the fence dammed areas than in the control plots, indicating the importance of groundwater access in addition to mitigation of browsing. By manipulating the factor of time, browsing at many sites for a long time, the researchers were able to show that carnivores were not causing landscape restoration. We have learned from science that things could be way more complicated, as they usually are. Our result is well supported by ecological theory and empirical results from over the world. Distributing food webs can cause resistant changes in ecosystems. Research in Yellowstone is common, but this study is rare in its manipulation of the landscape and its distribution. Hobbs and Cooper worked closely with park management and biologists, including Yellowstone National Park senior wildlife biologist Daniel Stoller, to answer questions relative to the park's needs and share results to help guide park policy. Its research contributes greatly to the understanding of Yellowstone by teasing out the degree of which complex links of food web affect ecosystems under native species recovery. Importantly, it is among the few published studies to date, the Yellowstone ecosystem that highlight that not just wolves, but multiple predator species together have contributed to changes in elk abundance. At this point, ramifications of how we evaluate how complex ecosystems respond to carnivores' presence and absence. He continues, long-term research conducted by the team also highlighted the value of national parks to help us understand ecological processes to better protect ecosystems. We should not only cherish the national resources of the parks they protect, preserve, people allowed to enjoy, because they are able to place where well-designed science can evaluate or understand its complexity. All right. So if you were able to follow all that, again, basically the idea was, there's, by those who are, environmentalists or animal, protectionists that, are against hunting and that type of thing, or that are, extreme in regards to protection of wolves, right? I wouldn't even say protection of non-management practices, I guess I would say, of wolves, bears, and mountain lions. There's go to a lot of their different websites or read articles from those groups, and they will very strongly suggest that simply adding these predators back onto the landscape, letting them do what they do, will fix everything. Again, that tropic cascade effect, that just by putting them back on the landscape will, right all the wrongs. Again, things, this study really highlights that things are much more complicated than that. Human interaction, depleting a lot of these predators off the landscape, yes, had a significant impact. But just simply putting them back on the landscape is not going to you know, put everything, you know, flip the coin and put everything back. You know, you can't really go back to that anymore because of the changes of, you know, the environment, you know, the human interaction, the, you know, we have expanded, you know, the country with, you know, human populations that you have to take that in consideration. And again, simply by adding the predators doesn't mean that, you know, the beavers are going to come back to the stream in this instance and, you know, put everything back. I mean, it's going to be more of a, you know, complex restoration process if you wanted to turn it back to what it was. You have to manipulate a lot of the populations of a lot of animals to be able to get that balance back, or, you know, that desired goal to try to get that balance back. So that's why, again, you know, you don't want to have an influx of, you know, one thing or the other. You know, in this instance, if, you know, the goal was, or if they had a project to, you know, do a restoration project, you know, it almost sounds like, okay, so now you need to, you know, manage those streams and areas where the willows are, you know, again, fence them off some manner, bring beavers onto the landscape, let them, you know, build dams undisturbed where they're not going to be, and again, preyed upon, you know, keep the elk away from those streams and willows. That way they can grow up, that way they can reestablish. And then maybe you might be able to get the achieved goal, but again, it's not going to be right away. And again, you know, with those predators, I know there's a lot of the apex predators that love to prey on beaver as well. So now you got, you know, additional food source. It, you know, things are going to get complicated. But again, just wanted to highlight this, that again, managing apex predators, like, yes, it is great to have them on the landscape. I think they should be on the landscape, but they need to be managed just like any other species and regulated to make sure that there's no imbalances or, again, issues that come up. You know, some people may not, you know, want to go, you know, agree with this, but, you know, we have to, you know, kind of decide, are we, you know, part of nature or above it, or are a combination of both? You know, when it comes to, you know, managing populations, are we only going to do it part way, or are we going to manage all populations? You know, kind of like in regards to the last story that I did, you know, in regards to the Park Service, you know, they want to put a bunch of money and effort into doing certain restoration projects, but yet they argue that they want everything to be just natural and on its own. You can't have your cake and eat it too, and you can't play both sides. You either need to manage those areas or don't manage the areas. You know, you're being really inconsistent by trying to, you know, do both. But that's it for these stories. Again, you know, just the ones I wanted to make sure I highlighted before they got too old and irrelevant. Again, there's always going to be more on these topics, but I just wanted to highlight these stories in particular because it certainly caught my attention and I didn't want to forget about them or not share them with you all. So I hope you enjoyed these stories. I hope you got something out of them. Again, there's always stuff going on in regards to, you know, wildlife and conservation. And these are just some of the stories that kind of caught my eye that I wanted to highlight for you. So, and with that, we're going to wrap this episode up. Again, hope you enjoyed it. Again, if you like this episode, make sure you hit that like button. And as always, get out there, be safe, and have fun.